Second World War was the most incredible and stupendous war in world history. It covered many, many nations of the world, and the cost of it was not like the cost of any other war in history. The Soviet Union, USSR, suffered a loss of 29 million people, 17 million civilians, 12 million soldiers, 29 million Russians and Russian allies died in World War II. Poland lost 6.27 million. Germany, 5.69 million people, which for Germany included almost 2.5 million civilians. And then down the list you go, Yugoslavia, Romania, Hungary, France, Italy, Great Britain, and then finally the United States. The United States lost about 413,000 soldiers, actually lost about 6,000 civilians in World War II. Most of the American civilians that died were in occupied areas before the war started and got captured principally by the Japanese and died in captivity. But the astounding civilian deaths from the other nations were in the paths of war, and they died in their millions. In World War I, 95% of the dead of World War I were military. World War II, 33% of the dead were military. So World War II was on a scale for civilians as well as military personnel on a scale unprecedented in history in terms of raw numbers. In terms of percentage of people, populations that died, there probably been some other wars of history that were just as significant in terms of percentage of population that died. But in terms of raw numbers, there wasn't anything else like World War II. And the United States was brought into it with the attack on Pearl Harbor. As I mentioned in the last hour, the Empire of Japan declared war by flying into Pearl Harbor to destroy the U.S. Pacific Fleet. One thing I did not mention, and it is an interesting point before I get to my major point in the other side of the world, is that after Pearl Harbor was wrecked so significantly, the new admiral in command of American forces in the Pacific, Admiral Chester Nimitz, who realized that he was going to be a central figure in the history of the world by taking command of the U.S. Pacific fleets and leading the United States against Japan. And so he picked a historian to write his biography and to study the war as they went through it in the Pacific. Anyway, he came to Pearl Harbor, and they got a seaman and a launch to take him around the harbor to view the destruction. And that's what they did. And as they were pulling back into the dock, the sailor turned to Admiral Nimitz and said, "Wasn't this a terrible thing that the Japanese have done? We have been devastated by this." And Nimitz said, "Oh, quite the contrary." He said, "The Japanese made three fatal mistakes, and it's going to cost them the war, and it's going to cost them the war pretty quickly, too." And the astounded sailor said, "When all this wreckage, what are you saying?" And Admiral Nimitz said, "Well," he said, "the Japanese, when they came, did not touch the fuel supplies, the U.S. fleet." These are very interesting provinces here. All of the oil and gasoline for all the airplanes and all the ships were stored at Pearl Harbor. And the Japanese ignored them. They wanted to blow up battleships. And by the way, only one battleship was a total loss. And that was the Arizona, because it flipped over. All the others were recovered and fixed up and sent against Japan. So even the wreckage could be repaired. He said, so first of all, they didn't hit our fuel supplies, and now we can hit back, and we can hit back right away. He said, secondly, they did not destroy the dry docks. The Japanese bombers did not wreck the repair sheds that we're going to use to rebuild this fleet. And we're going to rebuild it and rebuild it quickly. And he said, thirdly, they struck on Sunday. He said, and on the Sabbath day, there were a lot of men that were inshore at church and not on their ships. And he said, those men have been preserved to fight the Second World War in the Pacific. So he said the Japanese just made one fatal mistake after another. And they caused what looked like to be a huge amount of damage, but it was all repairable. And Nimitz got it all repaired and went back at them very quickly. And I'll tell some of that story a little bit later. I want to mention, too, welcome Mr. George McDearman, who is with us tonight. He is a World War II veteran of the Pacific. He was a Marine Corps naval aviator, and he's a member of our church, and we're glad to have George with us this evening to listen to a couple tales of the Second World War. He could probably tell some himself. We're glad he's here. What I want to talk about tonight mostly is the providence of God and the Second World War as it took place in Europe on the landings on D-Day on June the 6th, 1944. From the very beginning, the United States did not have a well-trained army, and England was begging for the U.S. troops to come and to get involved, and of course, Russia, Joseph Stalin and Russia met with the American president, Franklin Roosevelt, and begged him to and try to negotiate to get the United States troops into the war in Europe to draw away from Russia some of the German divisions that were devastating the Russian heartland. And the promise was made by the United States that we would get into Europe as soon as we could. And we told Stalin 1943 at the earliest. But as it was, the U.S. Army had to prove itself. And so the landings were made in North Africa, Operation Torch, the landings in North Africa where the American Army got its first experience at fighting against the Germans and the Italians, and it did not go well at first until the United States brought an American general by the name of George Patton onto the scene, and he and Omar Bradley and Dwight Eisenhower, the team that was going to, in the end, drive the German armies back into Germany and win the Second World War from the American side, they won their spurs in North Africa, fighting alongside the British. And then they were begged to land in Europe as quickly as you can, land in France, pull the German divisions away from the Russians. Promises were made. However, Winston Churchill had a different plan. He wanted to land the American troops in the Balkans, land them in Greece or in Yugoslavia or someplace like that, and strike back at the Germans through what was called the soft underbelly of Europe. In the end, the Americans agreed to a landing in Sicily and an invasion of Italy to try and knock Italy out of the war. But while they were doing that, the plans were being laid for the massive assault that's going to take place in France. And it's going to take place in June of 1944. At least a year, and in some cases for some units and some men, 2 years prior to that landing, the planning began for what is going to go down in history as D-Day. Now, I've been asked, I can't tell you how many times, what does D-Day mean? Why is it called D-Day? Why not some other day? And the answer is, nobody knows. There have been many D-Days in military history, and it meant the invasion of an enemy territory. But since June the 6th, 1944, there's only been one D-Day. When you say D-Day now, it just refers to one thing, and it was that day in June where the Americans and the British and the Canadians invaded France, hit the beaches, and began the drive to Germany. So D-Day today only refers to one D-Day, but prior to that, there were many D-Days. They had a D-Day in Italy, they had a D-Day in North Africa, they had D-Days in the Pacific. But the D-Day of Normandy was so huge, so enormous, that now it has become the D-Day. When you study the Normandy landings, the attack of the Allies on Fortress Europe, the more you read, the more you study that campaign, the more absolutely astounding and incredible the event really was. Remember the illustration I used the other night with a little Oriental rug and all the different things that have to take place in order to see the finished product, which is the successful D-Day landings. Well, this has that concept in ways that no other battle does. There were so many elements involved in this. And one of the interesting parts about it is most of those elements have been documented. And so to study D-Day, you can see the myriad strands of providence operating in the case of war, but in the case of a specific landing, a specific campaign, an incredible battle that doesn't have any parallels in the rest of the war. Nothing on this size and this scope and this importance. There are so many factors. It is incredible. And some of those factors are things that took place years before. For instance, fairly early in the war, during the attack on Britain, somebody got the idea of sending a large, sizable British raiding party into the port at Dieppe in France. So let's capture Dieppe. Or is it in Belgium? Wherever Dieppe is. Along the coast. And the Dieppe raid turned into a tragedy. The British and Canadian forces that landed there were trapped on the beaches. Lots of mistakes were made, and the whole raid was thrown back into the ocean. It was a disaster. But the British learned so much from that raid as they analyzed what went wrong that they were able to devise a plan for the Normandy invasion that closed all those gaps of the errors that were made at Dieppe. The sacrifice was great. There were a lot of casualties. A lot of men were captured by the Germans in that raid. But they learned a great deal about it, little realizing that what they learned at Dieppe would be put into practice a couple years later when they hit the Normandy beaches. It became a factor in the planning stages. So it was a disaster, and it was Churchill's disaster. He was a man who stumbled from one disaster to the next, but kept his cigar lit and his optimism at a high level, and planned the next victory. And he began getting them after that. Battle of Britain, of course, did not sink the island, and they succeeded in repelling the German attack on Britain. And they learned a lot from the attack on Britain. They learned everything there was to know about the Luftwaffe, that is the German Air Force. And they had plenty of examples of German planes to examine because they shot so many of them down. And they prepared for the battle of the skies over the skies of Europe. After the Battle of Britain, Britain began its bombing campaign of German cities. And the idea of flying over the coast of France took another turn as they figured how the air forces would figure into the invasion of Europe. D-Day is going to feature every arm of the military in both Britain and the United States, the Navy, the Army Rangers, the Army Air Force, all of them are going to be involved in the landing on D-Day, even the Coast Guard. It's going to be a remarkable event in history, one of the most remarkable events. The personalities of the men involved in D-Day are one of the interesting provinces to study when you, when you're looking at a battle of this magnitude. I mean, you can look at Winston Churchill, for instance, the hero of the hour, the man who was so excited about the planning for D-Day. In fact, after Eisenhower and Bradley and all of the British generals, Montgomery, the admirals, the Air Marshal Tedder, all of them, as they planned D-Day, all along, Winston Churchill has decided he is going to hit the beach with the troops. He's going to climb down the ropes, get into a landing craft, and land on D-Day. He was a man of uncommon courage and a remarkable, remarkable character, but creative, eccentric, bold, humorous, confident, occasionally depressed. And when he was depressed, he was really depressed. He called it the black dog. When the black dog jumped on his back, he couldn't see his way out, as he had great depressions. But he was not easily swayed, and he could be ruthless. He loved secrets. He loved espionage and spying. And he's going to use all the things he loves in planning the D-Day invasion. Anybody who had an idea of that had to do with espionage or spying or deception, when it came to Churchill, he gave it the thumbs up because he loved those things. And he was a man who was faithful to his wife. And he saw the big picture. He was the perfect person to be in command in Britain. On the other side, we have Adolf Hitler, a megalomaniac, ruthless, micromanager, blinded to all self-weaknesses. He made inspired and successful decisions early in the war, which made him believe that he was a superman and could not lose. He was very difficult when his generals opposed him. He did not trust the experts, and he ruled by fear. Not a pleasant picture, but it comes into play on D-Day. Because as the German forces are being slowly and inexorably driven back in Italy and in Russia, and they're about to land in France, and he knows that the Allies are coming, he decides that he's the master of the situation, and he will take command of all of the armed forces of Germany and France, and he will decide what tank battalions, what tank regiments, what tank divisions are going to be placed where. And he's going to decide where the attack is coming. And when there's a feint or a false attack, he's going to decide if it's the real attack or not. Because he's accumulated to himself a feeling that he has all the ultimate war knowledge that's necessary for victory, and that generals are men who are just moved around and replaced at will. That comes into play on D-Day in a very profound and impactful way. The generals who are going to take part in this massive invasion, each one has a very unique role to play. And as you study the character and the decision-making and the interchange between the generals and among the generals, it is a remarkable thing. You see providentially how men work together using their strengths in the end to make the decisions to make the invasion. And the man at the top was Dwight Eisenhower. As one man has said, history does not long entrust the care of freedom to the weak or the timid. Eisenhower had been jumped up over dozens of men ahead of him in rank. He had met years earlier George Marshall, who is going to be the head, who's going to be the head military advisor. He's going to rule over the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and be the man answerable to Franklin Roosevelt in the war. And earlier in his career, Eisenhower had, as a young officer, had run into Marshall, and they'd had some contact, and Marshall had given him an assignment. And the assignment was draw up a plan for the invasion of Europe. This was before World War II. What would you do if you had to land an army in France? And Eisenhower drew up an invasion plan. This was just a military exercise, a mental exercise, a strategic exercise. But he gave it to Marshall, and Marshall was very impressed. And when it came time to choose a general to command the American forces, Marshall said, I think Eisenhower's the man to do it. He has the kind of character that we need to deal with the British. And he hadn't even met Bernard Montgomery yet, who is the British general who's going to be the supreme commander of all the British forces in North Africa. And he's going to be over the Americans in North Africa, too. And, of course, he thinks he needs to be over all of the Allied troops that are going to land in Europe. And even though he's not, he pretends like he is. And he's going to be very difficult and eccentric. But Eisenhower was calm. He was a master strategist. He got along well with all sorts of characters, especially prickly allies. He's one of the few top generals with no previous combat experience. Almost everybody else had fought in the First World War, but not Eisenhower. He'd had a stateside assignment in World War I, much to his chagrin and dismay. He wanted to be on the battlefield, and he didn't get there. So he doesn't have the experience that some of the other men have. He served under George Patton during peacetime. Now he's over George Patton, or over Patton and Omar Bradley. So Georgie and Omar are going to, and they pronounce it Omar, were going to be taking their orders from Eisenhower, from Ike. He had strong nerves. He understood, most importantly, the political nature of warfare. Eisenhower understood that the big boss was Franklin Roosevelt. And the big boss in England was Winston Churchill. And he was the one who had to interface with all the politicians. And so he was the right man for the job. I didn't used to think a lot of Eisenhower. And over the last 4 or 5 years, I have read a lot about him. And he has risen and risen and risen in my esteem. The more I learned about Eisenhower, the more I admired him. And the more I realized he really was the right man for the job, at least on D-Day. He wasn't perfect. He made lots of mistakes in the war. But for the job that he had to do, as having the liaison with the British, he turned out to be just the right man. And then there was Bernard Law Montgomery. Eccentric, dynamic, prideful in extreme. When asked who the three greatest generals in history were, he replied that the other two were Napoleon and Alexander the Great. He was Scottish, raised in a strict Christian home. He had the total confidence of Churchill. He was aggressive, innovative. He was beloved by the rank and file. He wore sweaters and berets. He played a key role in the victory over the Germans in North Africa and Sicily and in France. But he had the unique ability to take a complex situation and explain it simply and then fail. And he loved the limelight, but in the end, he obeyed Eisenhower usually. Montgomery was difficult, and Eisenhower was able to work with him somehow. We don't know exactly how, but he did. Montgomery caused so much difficulty, and George Patton, American tank commander, had a terrible time with Montgomery. In fact, he wanted to shoot him a couple times, and had they been in the same place, he probably would have tried. And then there was Omar Bradley. He said, bravery is the capacity to perform properly even when scared half to death. One of his famous aphorisms. Former subordinate to General Patton, now his superior prior to D-Day, and through the European campaign, got along well with Eisenhower. He sacked more subordinate generals than any other
general in the army.
He got rid of men that made mistakes, and he got rid of them quickly. He fought a very frustrating campaign through the hedgerows of France. He made mistakes. He took the blame. He forged ahead. He was steady, and he was trustworthy. So the Allied team is going to work well on D-Day, almost perfectly. And then, of course, there was George Patton. Aggressive, overbearing, a dilettante. He was a millionaire, inherited money. He was a cavalryman. He liked to have horses around. He was an athlete. He demanded spit and polish. He had a difficulty obeying orders he didn't like. He accepts no excuse for failure. He leads from the front. He thinks he's reincarnated from great generals of past history. He's the most respected American general by the Germans. The Germans assigned psychologists to analyze the various American high command. And Patton was their favorite guy because they thought he was like them. I mean, he's predictable because he is like us. He's a fighter. He's aggressive. And, of course, we all know maybe we don't all know what happened to George Patton. During the Italian campaign, General Patton, who had no time for shirkers, people trying to avoid combat, and he was in a hospital. And he was pinning Purple Hearts on wounded soldiers. And he came across a soldier who was sitting on his bunk shaking like a leaf. And he said, "Son, where are you wounded?" And the doctor said, "He doesn't have any physical marks. He has, today it's called post-traumatic stress syndrome. Then it had other names, various names during World War II. But the stress from combat had broken his nerves. And Patton gave a shout, said, "We'll have no cowards in this army," and he slapped the soldier and told him he was weak and he was a coward and he didn't belong in the army. Well, that was not the first time Patton had run afoul of Franklin Roosevelt, because everything Patton did went in the newspapers and went to the front page of the newspapers because he was such a colorful person. There's only one speech he ever gave publicly that you can actually listen to on YouTube that isn't X-rated. His language was, they used the euphemism. So he was salty. You know, he had salty language. He was profane in the extreme. And he did things and said things that upset his superiors all the time. And Eisenhower had had it up to here with Patton and told him, "One more time, George, then you're gonna pay a very high price." He slapped the soldier. It was seen by doctors and nurses. They reported it. It went to the newspapers. It went to Franklin Roosevelt, and Eisenhower had to sack George Patton. He said, "George, you're not going to be a part of D-Day." And so Patton was withdrawn from the line and given a nice cushy billet in England, but no soldiers. And the Germans thought it was a ruse. You know, they gathered around, they read the paper. He slapped the soldier. Oh! Because they said that he was relieved of his command for slapping a soldier. The Germans thought that was the most transparent, ridiculous lie that anybody ever concocted. They didn't slap soldiers. They shot them. And they could shoot anybody they wanted to at any time, and nobody would say boo. And here, the greatest soldier the Americans had from the German perspective, George Patton, slapped a soldier and lost his command. Those Americans are so sneaky. They think we can't see through that. And so Eisenhower uses that in his planning for D-Day, because the deception campaign for D-Day is going to be so enormous and so complicated that books and books and books have been written just about the deceptions to try and fool the Germans about the D-Day landings. And one of them is George Patton. He plays a very key role in all of that. I would be remiss if I didn't mention another general of D-Day, and that's Erwin Rommel. You know, Providence directs the affairs of the enemy as well as those of the Americans and the British. Erwin Rommel, German general, was said of him, wherever Rommel is, there's the front line. And he led from the front. He was probably Germany's greatest and most competent general. But he did lose his army in North Africa. Eventually, he was forced out of North Africa. But it did not affect his career in the least. Hitler put him in command of the Atlantic Wall, of fortifying the beaches from all the way from Spain to northern France. And it was Rommel who began planting all of the anti-tank devices and installing artillery and huge concrete bunkers. They sowed a million mines on the beaches of the French coast. All of the defenses were Rommel's devising. Also in the fields of France, behind the lines, they put in large iron poles that would tear apart gliders. As glider troops would come into fields and try and land in flat fields, there were traps there to tear them to shreds and kill the men inside. He was a brilliant strategist. But Hitler wouldn't give him carte blanche to do what he needed to do. Hitler might try to micromanage what Rommel could have, what he could put out there, what decisions he could make, made by Hitler, not Rommel. Rommel was not turned loose to do his worst. He was kept on a tight leash. And the soldiers, Hitler decided that he didn't want a lot of troops along the coast. He kept them in the back. He kept them back miles so they could be used as a strategic reserve to send to wherever the threat came. So there are a lot fewer troops in the German lines on the beaches than there otherwise would have been had Rommel had the opportunity to place the troops, especially the armored troops, where he wanted. So the main characters of the drama all are going to play their unique roles. And when you see how they all fit together, you scratch your head and say, that is amazing. What could be the explanation of this? And the explanation, of course, is that God was engineering and preparing this invasion of Europe. Which is not to say God is on the side of the Allies or God is on the side of the Americans. We don't know the eternal counsels of the Almighty. But we look back in history and we examine what happened and we see what he did and all the components he used in the what we call the secondary causal realm to bring about this particular event, which eventually led to the end of the Second World War. So it is a remarkable thing just to examine these particular men. Operation Bodyguard, that was the overall deception plan for the Second World War. The British were the masters of deception and espionage, and they began it early. Churchill said, in wartime, truth is so precious that she should always be attended by a bodyguard of lies. And that's why the deception plan was called Operation Bodyguard. It's the bodyguard of lies. They're going to be fed to the Axis defenders of the beaches in France. And what a remarkable thing it is. And the key to it all, in fact, the key to probably the biggest key to Allied victory in World War II in Europe was the capture of a little machine that the Allies dubbed the Enigma. But it was the cipher machine that was used by the Germans in communicating secret cipher messages. The Navy had one and the Army had one. And the Army cipher it's interesting how it came about. We talk about generals and presidents and dictators and big plans. But the deciphering message, the ultra secret, this machine that encrypted all of the German communications and decrypted them, was assembled in England. When the Germans developed the machine, one of the engineers that was in the development process was discovered to have Polish ancestry. So the Germans kicked him out. He was a brilliant, brilliant engineer. And he memorized the Enigma machine. And then he let the British know secretly, and this was in the 1930s, late 1930s. He let the British know that he knew how to assemble the Nazi code machine. And the German and the English whisked him away to England, and they built one of these decrypting machines. And right away, they began listening in on all the electronic traffic that the German war machine is going to use in the Second World War in France and over Europe. The Germans never tumbled to it. So many times where they sent an armored unit to fight in a certain place and it got ambushed by squadrons of P-51s and totally annihilated. It just happened over and over again. And the Germans thought that they had a spy, a British spy or an American spy, somewhere in their high command. And they spent the whole war looking for him. And they didn't find him. They had no suspicion that the Allies had their little ultra secret, that they had the decoding machine, the Enigma machine, and that they were listening in on all the military traffic. So the Allies found out that the Germans had all kinds of spies in England. They turned loose a bunch of spies in England, and the English found out that the British found out that there were German spies coming to England. They caught them all, and they gave them Sophie's choice. They said, "You can spy for us as a double agent, or we can shoot you right here, and we'll bury you anonymously out in that field." And every single one of them decided that it might be okay to work for the British for a while. And so through the entire Second World War, the Abwehr, the German Secret Service, Army Intelligence, they were fed misinformation through the whole war by their spies in England, or all being run by Churchill. And all of their communications were being decrypted by the Enigma machine. So it's a remarkable providence that that machine fell into their hands. And Eisenhower later in the war said that D-Day could not have happened without it, and the victory in Europe would have been infinitely more difficult without it. They knew where the German combat units were going to be when they went into battle. They knew who it was. They knew who was opposing them, who the opposing general was, the opposing unit, and whether they were veterans or green troops. They found all that out from this particular piece of intelligence. So they did intelligence gathering. And there were different types of it, of course. There was visual intelligence gathering. They built dummy tanks out of plywood and fabric. And they let they built things that they wanted the Germans to see, and they'd let the German spy planes fly over as if the British weren't paying attention to them. And they would let them take all the pictures they wanted. They had phony towns that they built, and phony dummy artillery. And the biggest thing that they did, biggest thing the Allies did, the British and the Americans, is they created a phony army. And guess who they put in command of it? George Patton. He had the biggest army in Europe, and it didn't exist. And what they did is they gave him a bunch of different men who set up radio sets in different parts of England and then reported to headquarters of George Patton. And the Germans, we knew it. We knew that he was going to be behind all of this. And the Germans thought that there were 20 divisions of troops under Patton. There were phony commanders. There were reports. There were requisitions for equipment and uniforms. Just all the normal radio traffic of an army was created out of whole cloth. And Patton sat in his rocking chair and smoked cigars while all this phony stuff went out to the Germans, realizing Patton's going to lead the assault on Fortress Europe, which is what they expected to happen. One of the things the Germans had to be told was that the attack was going to be at the Pas de Calais rather than at Normandy. The Pas de Calais is the closest point between England and France, between the cliffs of Dover and Calais. And they wanted the Germans to think that that's where the assault would come. But they couldn't just tell them that. They had to put out all kinds of secrets for the Germans to figure things out. And they figured it all out. The attack was definitely coming at Calais. It was really coming at Normandy. And they were totally, totally deceived. The British set up the deciphering school at Bletchley Park. And they managed all the double agent broadcasts and all the decrypts. They put brilliant mathematicians to work there and scientists. They used special means of deception. They used double cross agents in France. They used spies. They used captured documents. And, of course, Patton's shadow army. All of these things went together. All these things worked together for good in the end. And, of course, the ultra secret, the Enigma cipher, was really the icing on the cake. And then on D-Day, they used their own intelligence forces and their connections with the French underground, who were set up to destroy German communication lines, remove road signs, and hide downed flyers and lost paratroopers, of which there were going to be many. So as you start putting the pieces together for Operation Overlord, it is one of the most amazing and complex operations in military history, probably the most complex ever assembled by men. And finally, the plans that Eisenhower put together had to come to fruition in a very narrow window of time. And the attack was set for June the 5th, 1944. On June the 4th, a huge Atlantic storm whipped up, and the weather became treacherous, and it got worse and worse and worse throughout the 5th. The hundreds of thousands of soldiers that were going to mount this offensive, in the end, there are going to be 2 million Allies on the ground in France. But on the day of hitting the beaches, there are going to be some 60 to 80,000, about 100,000 men on the beaches. On D-Day, they were already in their transports, because it takes a couple days. They were stationed all over the coast of England, and they all had to come around and assemble to get ready to cross over to Normandy. Thousands and thousands of pieces had to be put together simultaneously to make this work, and that's what the decision Eisenhower had to make was concerning the weather. And the weather for D-Day is the most interesting providence of all. And if we had time, we could look in the scriptures and we would see verse after verse after verse about how God controls the weather. Book of Job, it's all over the place. In the Psalms, in many places, we see the mighty hand of God controlling all things. And the weather is almost too obvious, as he controls his creation. But the weather got really bad. And the Scottish weatherman, J.M. Stagg, had to study all of the weather patterns and all the different things that were happening. And, of course, the Americans had their weatherman, too. And the Canadians had their weatherman. But J.M. Stagg is the one who had to report all of their findings to Eisenhower. And they postponed the attack from June 5th, and it was really up to Stagg to bring in a good weather report, and he couldn't, and he couldn't, and he couldn't. They had to be able to, the tides had to be able to overcome the obstacles on the beaches. The skies had to be clear. In fact, a full moon was optimal because the gliders and the bombers that preceded them and all the paratroopers that are going to be dumped across the French countryside, they have to be able to see where they are in order to gather on the ground and hit their objectives. The ships have to be guided on the way to France by the light of the moon. And it was so overcast and the ships were pitching so badly, the Navy said, "We definitely cannot go." And the Air Marshal said, there would be nothing but tragedy and loss if we go in this weather. And so Eisenhower had to decide, and he postponed. Bombers can't have overcast conditions. The Navy has to have high tides. The Army will take what they can get. There was competition, differing analysis among the main weather bureaus and prognosticators. Overlord would have to be decided on several days ahead of time because naval forces and transports were scattered from Scotland to Ireland. Well, suddenly, there was a break in the weather that was foreseen by Captain Stagg. And he went to Eisenhower and he made his report. And around the table were all the men who were going to lead the charge into Europe. Air Marshal Tedder, Lee Mallory, the Naval Commander Ramsey, and of course, Eisenhower and Omar Bradley and our good friend Bernard Law Montgomery. And so they're all around the table. Oh, and every time they take a vote around on whether to go or not to go, everybody says no except Montgomery. I think we can do it. And, you know, he's determined to hit the beach with his troops and win the war in a matter of a couple weeks. And he's assigned, the British have their sector, the Canadians their sector, and then the Americans, Utah Beach and Omaha Beach. And the 101st Airborne, the 82nd Airborne, they're going to jump behind the lines and open up the gates to the beaches for the men to get off the beaches. And so that's the overall scenario. The air commander goes to Eisenhower and he says, you need to call off the airdrops. Eisenhower made the decision to go on June the 6th. I mean, he made the decision on the 4th to go on the 6th. They postponed the 5th. But he made the decision. He heard the weather report. He got everybody's opinion. He said, well, that's it. We're going. And from that second till it was over, he was the most powerless man on the face of the earth. Once he set it in motion, it was gone, out of his control. The air marshal came to Eisenhower and said, I expect we're going to suffer 70% casualties with the airborne units. You have to call off the airdrops. Well, that coming from the expert on parachute troops and glider troops and this huge drop into the countryside of France, Eisenhower went to Bradley. And he said, Brad, it's been recommended that we cancel the airdrop. Will this succeed without the airborne units? Bradley said, it will not. We have to have them. And so expecting 70 to 80% casualties, Eisenhower gave the order for the airmen to suit up and get into their planes to be dropped over France. He went and met them. You've seen the pictures of Eisenhower standing there talking to the men in the 101st Airborne. And they had all the blacking on their faces. They had all their equipment. In fact, some of those guys were carrying 300 pounds of equipment. Mortars, shells, weapons of all different kinds, shovels, radios. One of the ones I read where the guy had 300 pounds besides his own weight to get on the plane. He couldn't get into the plane. They had to lift him up in, set him on the seat. And, of course, when he tumbled out during the airdrop, he cut loose all this weighty stuff. He wasn't about to go to the ground with 300 pounds on his back. And, of course, that stuff was all lost. The Germans had flooded the fields. Paratroopers were going to drop into flooded fields. Many of them were going to drown in 6 inches of water. Their packs were so heavy they'd come face down, couldn't move, couldn't get up, drowned. And that was going to happen widespread across some of the drop zones. In any case, the word was given, the paratroopers were ready, and it was out of Eisenhower's hands. Eisenhower wrote two messages. One of the messages he wrote to send to Franklin Roosevelt. Dear sir, the attacks have gone forth on the beaches of Normandy and France. They have been repulsed. We have been thrown back into the ocean. We have severe losses. We're trying to recover the survivors, and it is all my fault. He made that message up, and he wrote another message. The landings on D-Day have succeeded. There will be victory in Europe as the men are moving inland and connecting up with the airborne units. And he made a message. He wrote out a message to be read to the troops. I wish I'd brought a copy with me to read to you. It's one of the most stirring things you could ever hear, his message to the soldiers. It was a mighty endeavor, and it was the mightiest endeavor that men had ever embarked on. Well, you know, the weather affected the Germans, too. And here's how it affected them. The Allies, they know there's an invasion coming. They think it's at the Pas de Calais, but they're not sure. But one thing they are sure of, it's not coming during all this bad weather. And so what they do, Rommel went to his wife's birthday party way behind the lines. Colonels, majors, captains, generals scattered for the weekend. Back to Germany and back to Paris. Because they knew the Allies would not come in this bad weather. They could not come in the bad weather. But Stagg had figured out there was just going to be this brief window where the skies are going to be clear, the seas are going to be high enough and not rough, we're going to be able to do it. At least that's what he hoped. And Eisenhower had made the decision, the weightiest decision any soldier ever had to make. He could be sending 100,000 men to their deaths. And in fact, he thought he probably was with the airborne units. And so the key players of the German counterattack are not there. And the units, the German units, with their officers away, and with their armored units in the wrong places, mostly, the attack went forward. And on Omaha Beach, a lot of Americans were shot down. The Germans were ready there. There were things we didn't know about the beaches. But the whole place was hammered from the air by the bombers. There was no German plane that could see what was happening or even last 5 seconds in the air. All the Allied aircraft were in the air, flying mission after mission after mission, or sortie after sortie, over the French coast, while this massive armada of thousands of ships and hundreds of thousands of troops were moving to the shore. Well, man proposes, but God disposes. And it happened. They landed on the beaches. They took relatively light casualties. In fact, a small percentage of the total number of troops became casualties. The 23,000 infantry landed in waves. The 5,000 ships brought them in. Absolute air supremacy. The 4th Infantry Division was blown off course, and they landed almost unopposed. They lost 150 men in the landings on Utah Beach, the least of all the beaches. And some places, the sacrifice was great. Bedford, Virginia sacrificed almost all their men that were in the 29th Infantry Division, Virginia National Guard. And lots of great stories come from the landing of D-Day. And when you look at the whole picture and look at all of the things that went into this particular event, you say, these are remarkable providences indeed. And I've only scratched the surface of them. There are many, many others, many more, many interesting. But we see all the lines, all these different and various lines that had to come together in just the right way for this particular event to take place and to do so with success and without heavy casualties. And of course, Eisenhower sent the message of congratulations, the message of victory, of success. He was prepared. He was prepared, though, to take whatever blame could be issued. He's the man who made the decision. He was a leader of leaders. There are lots of fascinating stories, a number of Medal of Honor recipients, one of whom actually was Theodore Roosevelt. And with this story, I'll end. Speaking of the mysteries of Providence, Theodore Roosevelt was Theodore Roosevelt Jr. He had been wounded in World War I, and he had some pretty big shoes to fill. He was the son of the Theodore Roosevelt, hero and president of the United States, remarkable man, and here's his son with his name. A successful businessman, a soldier, a brigadier general. And his troops are going to land on Utah Beach on D-Day, and he's decided that he's a Roosevelt, and he has to land with his troops. General Barton, his commanding officer, said, he said, Ted, you can't go to the beach. You can't land with the beach. What would they say if you got killed or captured by the Germans that they had Theodore Roosevelt's son? And he said, that's the point. I'm Theodore Roosevelt's son. And there's a war to be fought, and there's a beach to be taken, and I want to go with my troops. And he persuaded General Barton to let him go. And it is interesting, he had severe heart problems. And he told his doctor he'd shoot him if he ever told anybody. And he walked with a cane. His commanding officer didn't know that either, because he had a bad leg. He climbed down the ropes. He hit the beach. He was the highest ranking officer in the first wave of any army. And he landed on the beach, and he just kept walking back and forth with his cane, whacking people to get them off the beach, yelling at them to move forward and hit the breaches with the bullets sailing all over the place. He was in his absolute glory. He was his father's son. And his son, who was named after his brother who was killed in World War I, his son was on Omaha Beach. So it's the only father and son first wave family landing, and they were Roosevelts. And in the end, he was awarded posthumously the Medal of Honor for his work on that day. There are all kinds of interesting providences that go along on the small scale and on the big scale, but they're all providences. They're all means that God used to accomplish his purpose, and his purpose on June the 6th, 1944, was for an Allied victory and the reinvasion of France, which led to the destruction of Nazi Germany and victory in World War II. It's an amazing tale of God's providence on the D-Day that has gone down in history. This June is the 70th anniversary of that landing. And I haven't said anything about what I do, but I lead history tours. And I wish we could go to Normandy, but we're going to go to the D-Day Museum in New Orleans. If you have an interest in any of my history tours, come and see me, and I'll give you my website. I should have had something up here for you, but we are going to go and celebrate D-Day at the great D-Day Museum in New Orleans on June the 6th. But I thought, in thinking about this, giving this program tonight, this is the 70th anniversary, and it's coming up this year, and it's one of the most amazing providential events in world history.